Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tej Su, and on behalf of LSE Media Group, which is an alumni organisation that is interested in media affairs in the broadest sense, I would like to welcome you today to what promises to be a fascinating expose of the book publishing industry. The event shall be chaired by the good Kai Bradley, a former chief executive of Publishers Association. And I really am indebted to Kai for his passionate involvement in helping produce the event and putting together such an illustrious panel. I would also like to thank the Man Group for kindly sponsoring the reception that will follow this event, and also to the LSE Alumni Office for helping with the logistics. Thanks very much, and now I'll hand you over to Kai Bradley.
Well, thank you very much, Tej, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you all hear okay if I talk like this? Is that okay? Fine. Thank you all very much for coming along on such a hot evening, one of the first hot evenings for some time, and I was slightly scared that a lot of people would vanish into stand by the Thames and have a drink or something rather than coming here. As it is, I find I've got an audience which is divided between people from the LSE who are students and people from the book trade and publishing itself, including many people in the audience who probably know as much or more about some of the topics we're going to talk about as even those people on our panel. But I'm sure we're going to get a very lively discussion going, and our panel is quite exceptionally distinguished in talking in its experience about publishing and ability to talk about publishing. My plan is that we'll have a discussion which will last somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour, depending upon how things are going. Then we'll have something like half an hour of comments and questions from the floor, which we hope you'll all participate in. And then, as Tej says, there's a reception generously sponsored by the Man Group, who, of course, are also the sponsors of the Booker Prize. One of my jobs this evening is not to talk too much, and some of you will know that that might be difficult for me, but I do have a panel which is also quite capable of talking at some length. And in our preliminary discussion now, I've been told that the agenda we have is far too long. We don't have a hope in hell of getting to the end of that particular agenda, and it's my job somehow to work it out and make sure we do talk about the things that most interest you. But on the panel, starting from my right, we have Carol Blake, who's a leading literary agent, represents many distinguished authors. She tells me she had a long career in publishing before she became an agent. I wouldn't have said that myself, Carol, but mainly in the rights business and in marketing, and I think many of you will know her already as an agent. She has actually published a book herself on how to get published, which is a highly dangerous idea, I have to say, to put into any putative author's mind, because there are far too many people trying to be published at any one time. Then on her right is Anthony Cheatham, who is the founder and former chief executive of the Orion Publishing Group, which he sold to the French publisher Hachette about 2 years ago now, and more than that, I suppose. How long ago?
Five
years ago, yes. And Hachette, of course, in turn is owned by Lagardère. Orion, which might not be quite as well known as Penguin, for example, which Peter Mayer was head of for a long time, has two main groups in it: the Orion Group itself, very distinguished crime list and general publishing list, and of course Weidenfeld, which does the more, dare I call them, quality books within that particular group. Before that, Anthony founded another publishing company called Century Publishing, which was merged with Random House to become Random Century, and that already owned the former Chatto, Bodley Head and Jonathan Cape group. So Anthony is sort of a living example of the mergers and conglomerations taken place in publishing over the past 10 or 20 years. On Anthony's right is Peter Mayer, who is a major American paperback publisher. He was a former chief executive of Penguin Worldwide, and he spent 10 years running Penguin from here in London and then from New York. And we've described him in the blurb quite rightly as being legendary, and I think I would add the word charismatic to that, which a number of our panel may be as well. Peter's interesting that he's moved from running one of the major world publishing companies to two what we might call small publishing houses, one on each side of the Atlantic, Overlook in the United States and Duckworth in the UK. And of course Duckworth is a very distinguished publisher in his time of more literary books. On Peter's right is Stephen Page. He's the chief executive of Faber & Faber, the distinguished literary publishers, which were in fact the publishers of last year's Booker winner, Werner Godd-Little. And Faber has a long string of literary and other successes to its credit. And it was also behind the musical Cats, of course, based on T.S. Eliot's old Possum book of practical cats. T.S. Eliot was, interestingly, a director of Faber, and Faber still manages the Eliot estate. And then on the far right, Tim Waterston, also, I think, entitled to that epithet of legendary, founder of the eponymous bookselling chain Waterston's, which had a branch, I know it's about 100 yards from here within the LSE, the first of the new innovative chains in bookselling, and he became chairman of it when it merged with EMI Record Shops to become HMV Media, and Tim is always looking to buy Waterston's back. He did recently acquire the Early Learning Centres and is reported to be wanting to make a £1 billion bid for WH Smith, which he worked for in his time. Before I open it up to the panel, it might just be worth saying one or two things about publishing, book publishing. It is a complex industry. It's got many different markets within it. We'll be talking mainly tonight about what we call trade publishing, which is the fiction and general books mainly sold through booksellers, because there's also educational publishing, academic publishing, reference publishing. There's a whole area, an important area of exports, rights sales, translations, tie-ins with other media and the like. But we'll be primarily talking about trade, but given that we're in the LSE, you may well want to stretch the agenda a little bit when we get to the discussion stage. It's fair to say, I think, that current reports on the state of publishing show that it's pretty healthy at the moment. Lotus reports show something like an 8% increase in sales, both by value and volume, over the last year, which is a pretty good performance by any standards. And a lot of company reports are now coming in for the past year, showing that the publishing companies are getting back to a fairly high level of profitability. Though, as we all know, there's still some major problem areas. I mentioned WH Smith's, which is well known at the moment to be up for acquisition, and which has had a very bumpy ride over the past few years. In fact, the industry has pretty much grown over many years in line with gross domestic product, or done better. But we did have a particularly bad patch about 10 years ago after Britain was expelled from the exchange rate mechanism, and there was a big recession at that time which hit publishing fairly hard. And that led to a fairly major crisis in the book trade, which culminated in the ending of something called the Net Book Agreement, which had been a very important part of the structure of the publishing industry over many years, and that was quite cataclysmic in the changes it brought about. Now you get a great many comments made about the state of the industry to set out something of the agenda. The increased sales, more discounting of best-selling titles, have certainly succeeded in finding many more readers of books, and I don't think anyone's going to argue about that being a good thing. But there's a great deal of controversy over the effects of conglomeration amongst both publishers and booksellers. In publishing, there are now 6 or 7 main trade groups, as well as many small publishers still, one has to say. There's controversy about the effects of foreign ownership, largely coming via the United States, New York, but as has been pointed out to me forcefully this evening, with Germany, Bertelsmann and other companies like that, very much the owners at the end of that particular chain. We've got the big new bookselling chains. Tim Waterston, when he formed Waterston's, was accused of genocide of smaller booksellers, which he may want to deny now, but that led to the great movement of the chains. There's much greater selling of books through supermarkets than there used to be. This is sometimes thought to lead to a reduced range of stock, putting smaller booksellers, in particular smaller publishers, under intense pressure. And my own local independent bookseller, The Open Book in Richmond, the owner there tells me that she could buy most bestsellers now more cheaply from a supermarket than she could from the wholesalers who otherwise would supply her on the terms she gets from there. And of course, considerable controversy about the position of authors. We've also seen some polarization between the best-selling authors and new authors, and what you might call consistent authors, finding it, they claim, much more difficult to publish. So what we've seen in the last 10 years or so has been a major shift in the power balance inside the trade, away from the suppliers to the distributors, putting suppliers under much greater pressure. Well, given the strange nature of the publishing industry, the mix of commerce and culture that we have in it, I thought it might be interesting to ask our panelists first what made them come into this highly complex and interesting and difficult trade and how they actually see it now. And I'm going to start at the end of the supply chain, so to speak, with Tim, because I know that Tim started his career, I think, in Allied Breweries as a brewer. Then you moved to W.H. Smith's, and only later did you move into founding Waterstones. What made you come into the book trade, Tim, and what were your objectives?
Well, I was with Allied Brewers for years. I was a marketing director, ultimately marketing executive, then marketing manager, and marketing director. So my background was all marketing. Before that, I was in an advertising agency. So when I was fired by W.H. Smith, I was on the sort of fringes of the book industry with Smith, but only really on the real fringes of it. And then they fired me in 1981, and in 1982, I should say. And I started Waterstones. You're talking about the mix between commerce and culture, and I think it was exactly that for me, really. First of all, I had a passionate longing never to work for a corporation again as long as I lived, under any circumstances. And I just wanted to start a business. And what I thought there was, and really it turned out to be very correct, was what I thought there was an extraordinary hole in the market for somebody who would take Smiths on. Smiths were admirable in many ways, completely dominated the book trade in the early 80s. But they were not my idea of literary booksellers, and I thought that we could combine both something which was financially stable and financially rewarding with something which we would get an enormous amount of cultural pleasure of. So it really was a mix of commerce and culture for me. I'm not sure which was the more important. I mean, they're both very important. We were bringing in money from outside. We had to make proper returns on our money. At the same time, it was a sort of messianic drive, really, to spread books and spread literary bookshops throughout Britain, and it was an unbelievably exciting period of my life.
Do you think that's fallen back now? I mean, you want to take over Waterstones again, you're constantly reported to be doing that, you now want to, they say, acquire W.H. Smith, you might have some competition for that, but is your motivation there that you see things having declined against your
motivation? Absolutely no comment on W.H. Smith whatsoever. As far as Waterstones is concerned, Waterstones is not for sale. Yes, I mean, I do think that Waterstones is still admirable and it does a wonderful job, but I believe the instincts of the current owners are to reduce the literary quality of the shops, and were Waterstones become available and were we able to strike a price which was agreeable, I would certainly like to own it again. But I mean, there's plenty of other things going on in my life, and that's not something which is dominating every waking minute of my life, but I think Waterstones is both financially more successful and culturally incomparably more satisfying when it takes the literary high ground and really presents itself to the public as the best literary bookseller there's ever been. And, you know, if I ever did find myself fortunate enough to acquire it again, I would certainly move it absolutely straight up the market again, I mean, instantaneously, to where I think it most naturally sits.
Anthony, you've really seen it all. You've set up companies, you've acquired companies and merged them. Set up a very important new publishing company now. What was your motivation? Were you more motivated by business or by what you wanted to publish? And how do you see what's happened?
Well, my first job was actually working at teaching Tibetans on a raspberry farm in Norway. And one of the difficulties I had was how to teach them history. Because where do you start? You can't start with the Tudors and Stuarts if you're in Norway and teaching Tibetans. So I looked for a book that actually set out world history for older children, and it didn't exist, so I thought I would come back and try and write it. To my great alarm, Tom Master at Cape said, what a good idea, go and do it. After 3 months of this, I thought, actually, it would be much easier to commission this from someone who knows more about history than I do, for which you had to be a publisher. So that's why I joined publishing.
How do you see things having developed since then with mergers and acquisitions and changes in ownership?
Well, I think the main change has been simply the getting bigger. And, you know, there is no doubt starting a company is huge fun. You've got everything at risk, but it's also great fun. It's an adventure. You take part in every decision, and it's difficult to beat. But as you get bigger, and I put the big point at around 50 million turnover, if you're the boss, you get more and more detached from the business, and your colleagues don't like you to make publishing decisions quite so much as they did. And you begin to feel rather as if you were taking part in the First World War naval arms build-up. You know, instead of running around in interesting boats, the dreadnoughts just get larger and larger, and they become these sort of gun platforms. Instead of guns, there you have big altars. And basically, that's what the large corporations are now. They are just mainly brand platforms. And they're awfully protective. You know, I think the sense of adventure goes out of it. You don't actually require editors to tell you that the next John Grisham is going to be successful. So I think the whole editorial function is slightly less important. It's slightly devalued in the context of these larger companies.
Could you argue in a company like Random House, which has actually preserved quite a lot of the imprints and so on, which have come in there, Jonathan Cape and so on, that actually there is not quite that centralisation and domination from the top that you talk about, but that the effect can be, the companies are so large, that the heads of the different imprints have to have more influence over their titles?
Well, some of the conglomerates having all those imprints reminds one of some sort of baronial hall where you have sets of antlers up on the wall. They sort of represent things that people have bagged in the past, and they have no actual reality. But I think that the large corporation that succeeds will be the one that actually manages to have a federal system, a properly federal system, where power is properly delegated down and where the creative function is still seen as supremely important. And I think all the big companies are experimenting with that in one way or another, with varying degrees of success. But they will probably get it right in the end.
Yeah. Just move to Stephen Page from Faber. You started your career in a fairly small publishing company that almost reversed, took over HarperCollins, one might say, and you went to HarperCollins. You're now back at Faber, which is possibly the leading literary publisher, which is independent, so to speak. One always heard that it had been safeguarded against being taken over by anybody at all, which one doesn't know whether that actually applies these days. Do you feel threatened by the big publishers, or do you enjoy the independence and more freedom that you might have?
I think the market's very much a mixed economy. At Faber, firstly, of course, I will tell you that there is no prospect of Faber ever being taken over. The important thing about that is that Faber has investors who are really interested in our cultural aspects of our publishing while looking for some kind of commercial success. Balancing those two things is very much what Tim was talking about. You know, you cannot be purely cultural in your efforts if you are running a business, but at Faber we spend a lot of the time being sure that we balance both sides of the argument. So, you know, I think the money talks, you know, our investors are very, very keen that we do that. So we're able to publish in a manner that some of our competitors are not. We don't have the same demands made of us in terms of pure profitability. We have other measures for our success. So I would say, you know, I see Faber as quite a different kind of animal to our competitors, but I also think we have to be extremely adept at some of the skills that have predominated in corporate publishing life. So marketing skills, packaging skills, ambition, a great sense of sort of lustre about the commercial performance. These things have to coexist with the cultural side of things. But I think if you hire the right people who have an intelligence about this and can balance the two things, you can create a very different kind of organisation. And I think the reader benefits.
It may be you've got a new rival coming up sitting on your left at the moment with Peter, who is, say, head of one of the greatest publishing companies of all time, I would say Penguin, on both sides of the Atlantic, which is a pretty large responsibility, and he did some very dramatic things there, and is now the owner, I think, Peter, am I right in saying, and the boss of both Overlook and Duckworth. Do you have ambitions to form companies rather like Faber, or do you see them growing into more mass market companies, or is it perhaps a hobby that you want to do after your earlier distinguished career?
Well, I certainly think I put in too many hours to call it a hobby, so I'm very serious about it, just as I am serious about publishing and about books. I don't think I have any ambitions at all, such as those you describe, although it'd be marvelous to even approach what Faber has achieved for so long, and I may even say with its new energy as part of its current reality. I think some of the things that I've been doing, at least until now, are more like, if you're thinking of an ambition, are more like those Russian dolls you can buy in Russia, where I have acquired companies, each one smaller than the one before. So I don't think size interests me. And in fact, I don't think size ever did interest me. Of course, I did run a very large company, that's true, with some very brilliant colleagues, I may say. And I don't think size interested me very much even then. But being profitable did. We were owned by a publicly owned company. And I did recognize that one had to be profitable, but the size by itself I don't think is very interesting. And I do think one of the changes that has increasingly taken place in publishing has to do with the concern for market share, ever greater market share, as a kind of panacea or as a kind of solution for the targets that are imposed on companies that are publicly owned, or even privately owned, as in the case of Bertelsmann. In other words, the thought that you can increase profitability by acquiring more and more companies, which is to say more and more backlists, have a larger revenue against a constant or even decreasing overhead, at least as a percentage of the revenue. So I think a lot that has happened to publishing has been sort of publishing by the numbers, which is very different than the idiosyncratic nature that was true of publishing when I was younger, and still continues in many quarters, but I don't think is the overriding nature of either publishing or bookselling. And the size that everybody has referred to, and you first, Clive, that has taken place, the growth in both sectors of the market, I think it has something very much to do with that. And I think the problem for companies, large and small, has much to do with the entrepreneurial spirit, which it is not easy to maintain or instill in large companies. And it is sort of the nec plus ultra of what small publishing is about. Very few small publishing companies are not led by people who are themselves editorial, creative, because you sort of have to be. There are no systems and no size that will carry you along.
When you first came to work in London, Peter, in charge of Penguin, you were seen as something of a hatchet man, if I remember, and there's a lot of publicity, even notoriety, given to the reduction of the Penguin list that you did at that time, your culling of the list, doing a sort of Dr. Beeching, if you remember Dr. Beeching, on the Penguin list. What was your reason for doing that?
Well, I don't think that's what I did.
Right.
What I think I tried to do was make some sense out of what was a very great mess that I inherited, but with very many brilliant people there, and to instill some order and some rededication to backlist. And to do that, one had to think of new ways to enlarge backlist. One of the things that we did, because I don't think I did anything by myself, was to promote the idea of what became known as B-format publishing, which made it possible to actually have more titles in print by slightly increasing the production cost and by increasing the retail price by a bit more than that. It made it possible to print fewer copies and have more titles in print. And I think by the end of probably my third or maybe fourth year at Penguin, I didn't keep any statistics, probably Eric Blake did, the backlist was as large or larger than it was when I came. And in fact, things like the classics, the Penguin classics, went from, I don't know, something like 400 titles to 1,400 titles. But many things had to be done to work one's way out of what I was presented with. So I think that is perhaps a slightly more accurate
exercise to start with, so to speak. Yes,
one had to change things, and also
a bit of operation,
change people's thinking.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the beginning of it all, the authors and the agents who represent authors. Carol, one complaint I'm always getting from my friends who want to have their books published is not only can they not find a publisher, they can't even find an agent. And these days, to get your book published, all you really must have an agent. That's a fairly big change in how things have actually happened, isn't it? Are authors these days finding it much more difficult to publish than they did as you found it earlier in your career?
I think that, thanks for putting the stress on how long I've been in publishing, Clive.
I
think that it is more difficult to get published now. I think it is very difficult, we all know it is, to find an agent. Of course, a lot of people can't write well, and there's a very good reason why they don't find an agent or a publisher. But size doesn't matter, I once overheard, was something that nice women say to nice men. The problem we have in this business now is that size of publishing companies matters a great deal to authors. They would like the company to be small when it deals with them. They would like to know that they know everybody there. But conversely, they and I and we, agents in general, would like to know that the publisher has muscle in terms of marketing and selling. And sometimes you can't go for both. The art is to aim for what's right for the author at that point in their career. I mean, that's why I like being an agent, because I like selling rights and I like directing an author's career. But it is by no means straightforward, and it's not just posting nice manuscripts about, as I think my mother thought it was when I said I was going to become an agent after being a publisher.
I just wanted to read a quote, actually. I don't know how many of you know Jonathan Coe as an author. I think he's one of the best authors going at the moment, so to speak.
He's not mine.
He's not one of yours, I'm afraid, no. But he's a nice book which was published almost 20 years ago, I think, A Touch of Love. And he wrote in that, if I can find the right passage, the character speaking, "My writing falls into two distinct categories. There's my creative writing, not the best word I know, but I can't think of any other, and my critical writing. Now, what distinguishes my creative writing, what it all has in common, what gives it a sort of thematic unity, is it all, without exception, unpublished. None of it has ever appeared in any printed form whatever, and none of it has ever attracted a word of praise or approbation from any agent, editor, or publisher's reader. Some of it, on the contrary, has elicited letters of rejection expressed with a fervour which can only be described as religious." And then, even within this category, there's a further distinction to be made between that which has simply never been published and that which, moreover, has never been read. And one's aware, bringing Stephen back in, that last year's Booker winner, Vernon God Little, was allegedly, at least, discovered on your slush pile by a casual reader who was set to sort out the slush pile and find whether there's any glimpse of any gold in it anywhere, and recovered this book, which went on to win the Booker Prize. A strange book, you might say, slightly dumbing down, but I actually think a brilliant book.
Well, I'll take issue with almost all of that. Firstly, we didn't discover it on the slush pile. Interestingly, it was on the agent's slush pile. It came to us in quite a rough form in some ways, but we and a number of other publishers saw the good in it, and we leapt faster than others. So I think there's an interesting point about slush piles. I mean, at Faber, we receive maybe 6,000 novels a year unsolicited. I mean, that's outside. We also receive perhaps 6,000 or 7,000 poetry collections a year. We employ 60 people, of whom 14 are in editorial. When are we supposed to evaluate properly these slush piles? Now, obviously, in the poetry arena, where there's very little agenting, we're very dutiful about it, and we go about it. It's very, very difficult in the fiction arena, and also because I think agents play a much stronger role in identifying the talent and weeding out a lot.
Interesting point. If I can leap in there, I thought that Stephen was going to say at the beginning that he did find DCVPA in the slush pile, and I was going to say that makes Faber quite surprising if they do read their slush pile to that depth, because one absolutely marked thing that has happened in the time I've been in publishing is the shift from where you expect the talent spotters to be. It used to be editors at publishing houses who regularly discovered new talent. Now I get manuscripts rejected by publishers because editors will say, "I'm sorry, I can't take this on, it needs editing." And I think to myself, "Oh, silly me, what's your job title?" But to be serious, it is agents these days who do most of the talent spotting. And we get a hell of a lot more than 6,000 manuscripts a year. And we employ 20 people max, including accounts. So.
One of your competitors has, in fact, appointed an editorial director, hasn't he, to do editing?
Oh, I mean, not the only one.
You know.
I don't think we're really competing. I think we're colleagues.
Well, I'll leave that to you to sort out, so to speak.
Well, I don't want his clients, I'm sure he doesn't want mine.
What I'd like to do, I think one of the great big topics at the moment is how far this process of conglomeration has led to a process of dumbing down, in particular, globalization. How far is the fact that many British companies are now owned by American companies, who in turn owned by German companies, how far is that moving towards publishers being world publishers, i.e. publishing their list universally, so to speak, rather than their being published by one publisher in the United States, one publisher in the United Kingdom, and maybe other publishers elsewhere? When the famous thing called the British Publishers Market Agreement went about 25 years ago, it was seen that that was an almost inevitable move towards globalization of titles and the great global companies dominating with titles they would publish in both the United States and the United Kingdom. Has that come to pass at all? Have you seen that?
No. And you know why? Because publishers never agree with each other. People always say if you put six editors in a room, you'll get seven opinions. And because I like selling rights separately, because I like selling each market separately for my author, because I want my author to have a direct link to the publisher that publishes them in each market, it's quite seldom that pieces of one conglomerate worldwide will all come to a book with the same editorial and marketing passion. And I'm not at all displeased by that.
Peter, did you ever have any ambition to publish titles globally through Penguin, or did you try to preserve the more national structure?
Well, I think the first book that we ever published that we did globally turned out to be Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, and that meant us our company for quite a number of years, and we thought about it after that. But I actually thought about that a great deal. But I don't think that what Carol says, which I think is right, actually impacted on us, because what we did in those Penguin years, and it has changed quite a bit since then, was to try to have an editorial niveau that was roughly congruent between all the different Penguin companies. In other words, the lists of whether it was Penguin Australia or Penguin South Africa or later on India, Canada, all bore a resemblance to each other. They were not identical, but they were quite similar, so that in fact what we were interested in, there were exceptions, were generally interesting to our companies overseas. The great exception to that was, predictably perhaps, Penguin in the United States. And that was one of the reasons, there were others, one of the reasons that after I had been here in Britain for 10 years, I went to the United States to make Penguin in the United States more a company that was like the rest of our group. And one of the first things I think I did was to change the name of our company to Penguin USA. That was only symbolic, but that was my idea, that this brand was very important, was a symbol of some kind of quality, even if you couldn't articulate it at all times, or sometimes ever, but that it stood for something. And Penguin today has gone a somewhat different route. People are more in charge, very much as Carol was suggesting, of their own destiny in their own country, so that the lists are now more divergent, and I think more of that issue that Carol raised is a factor. But the first part of your question related to globalization and dumbing down, and I didn't quite understand it, but I don't think actually there is any connection between the two, or only a remote one. Most publishers publish their books in a relationship to their own market. There are many reasons for dumbing down, either real or apparent, but I don't think it has to do with globalization.
I was referring, Peter, to the general idea that publishing is increasingly run by accountants or people with who are masters of business administration or something like that, that happens in the large companies. The more profitable books have got to be published and the less profitable get chucked out. And let's come on to this, that the American end of the business, the headquarters, so to speak, might have a greater control over what happens in the United Kingdom. You're rebutting that. But Anthony, did you find that in when you were with Random Century? How did you find your relationship worked out with New York?
Well, can I just get back to the other question?
I think the conglomerate threat, if you like, opportunity, some might say, really not just has to do with size, but with what the conglomerate is actually doing. So the most alarming thing is to find yourself owned by a media conglomerate that changes its mind about the role of books in the whole media spectrum. For example, when everybody decided that we were going electronic and digital with everything, you know, the bookend became very unsexy, and nobody wanted to invest in it. Nobody really thought this was a big opportunity. So publishing does get sometimes, book publishing, sometimes get diverted by the other concerns of the conglomerate. And I think Bertelsmann, in a way being the biggest, is sort of fairly lucky in that books are a very major part of it. When I was part of the Hachette Group, you know, their overwhelming concerns were in other media, not necessarily in making armaments and missiles, which was one division, but in, say, magazines and in radio and television.
We talked a bit about small publishers and about Faber as in some way being ring-fenced, perhaps from being taken over. But if you look at the experience of some other small publishing companies, like one might take Harville, for example, run by Chris McElhose, he was demerged from HarperCollins, it remained independent for a short period of time, and then was absorbed back again into Random House. You get other smaller publishing companies which are very lively and successful, like Canongate, for example, in Edinburgh. Do small companies have a chance now, or are they finding that the fact that the book-selling chains are so powerful and so dominant, and the book-selling chains like perhaps to buy more easily from the established large publishers, do small publishers in fact find they're now so disadvantaged that they can only operate under the umbrella of a large company?
I actually feel it's the things have swung the other way. I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the independent publisher looked very much under the cosh. But I think that's changed, and it's changed for a number of reasons, because a large number of things have gone right for independent publishers recently. 3 out of 4 Booker Prizes. The number one book last Christmas was published by Profile Books, Eat, Shoots and Leaves. There's a certain glamour and energy around companies such as Fourth Estate in the 90s through into Canongate, what we're trying to do at Faber, Duckworth, Profile and others. So there's actually a thriving community of independents. And what's interesting is the degree of interest shown in these companies by the retailers. Because I think what Anthony said is right, that the major companies have a major job to do, and it's about major brands and it's about best-selling lines. But that isn't everything for a range-holding bookshop. I think one of the other problems for the reader is that a lot of that publishing that comes out of corporations is made easier for retailers to buy. And there's a certain ablandizing going on in terms of packaging, and I think the serious reader particularly finds it quite difficult to differentiate between a Birdsong and a Dostoevsky. You know, the market is merging into a bit of a mush. And independent publishers, I think, have the time and energy to not only make books right, you know, to make them look appropriate for their market. I'm not saying that corporate publishers don't do that, but I think independents have the time and energy to do it for everything. But also, they work incredibly hard at finding readers for books that are not in the top tier of bestsellers. They work incredibly hard. I mean, we generate about £1 million worth of publicity a month for, you know, if it was ad space, for our titles, and we don't have a bestseller every month. So I think there's something about the energy that those independent publishers bring that has made them really necessary to the market. Whether they'll be able to survive, whether the money will stay in place, whether they'll find investors to get them through the difficult, you know, progress that you need to go through, is to be proven. But it's an exciting moment.
It used to be thought, wasn't it, that if you're a small publisher, you could set up, use your enterprise, start. When you reached a certain size, life got difficult, and that's the time you ran into trouble and had to find somebody to take you over, so to speak. Do you think those companies are now getting beyond that and are beginning to cope with growth?
I'm not sure that's proven, because I think certainly at Fourth Estate, let alone the 50 million mark, Anthony, you know, we hit the 8 million mark and couldn't find investors who wanted to see that through. They'd had enough risk. They were too anxious about it. So I think, but maybe that doesn't matter. You know, maybe just others will spring up. You know, I don't know.
Peter?
Well, I think Stephen's right. What's curious is that in the last, let us say, 15 years in Britain, not in the United States, interestingly enough, and I'm not quite sure why not in the United States, but certainly in Britain, I think there are five or six companies, I think they've been mentioned, Bloomsbury, 15 years or so old, I don't know what the right numbers are, Headline was new, Orion and Century are new, and Canongate is relatively new, got a restart, Profile is new. I think I've joined, actually, a movement. And I don't entirely know why it works or seems to be working in Britain, but it absolutely is. And I think it may partly be because there is a sympathy out there for independence in a time where many people are appalled by things having gotten too large. I certainly enjoyed running a very large company, but everything has gotten much larger in the 8 years that I've been gone. It's not just the publishers, it's also the bestsellers themselves are very, very large and perhaps squeeze out some other books. The retailers have gotten very large. Everything is large. That must be the style of our times, because it isn't just book publishing, it's not just retailing, it's everything, it's every industry. This is nothing peculiar, actually, to book publishing. But when people do something that's independent, I think people cheer.
Let's bring Tim back into the argument. Tim, undoubtedly, when you set up Wollstone's, you tried to carry a very wide range of titles, and what is more, be open on Saturday evenings and Sundays and so on, so people could actually go and buy books at the time they were available to buy books. Nowadays, it's often said the big book-selling chains are really rather identical in the stock they carry, that you can't distinguish between one book chain and another book chain, and they concentrate too much on the best-selling titles, and at the risk of to the loss of diversity of title, to the loss of local authors and people who might otherwise be stocked. Is that your view of what's happening in bookshops?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a tremendously complex subject, and we could be arguing here until 10 o'clock at night. I mean, I think that the great skill of bookselling certainly is to realise that 80, 85%, 90% of your revenues actually come from the backlist, not the front list. And the skill of backlist bookselling is mixing your stock between titles which will turn regularly and well all the year with some which won't. But it's the ones that don't, if they're properly selected, actually provide the flavour and the character of the bookshop and bring people in, and then you'll sell many more books. But just reversing, you mentioned Christopher McElhose, and I'm, you know, speaking as an ex-shareholder of Harville, Christopher did some wonderful publishing, but he didn't manage to find that balance between commercial control, commercial success, and cultural success. And that is not indicative of the fact that the world is no longer kind enough to small publishers. The world has got bigger, and as it gets bigger, I think more and more small startups will come through. The problem with trade publishing and the problem with startups in trade publishing is that they are monumentally cash requiring. You know, trade publishing is not a cash generative business. Big or small, it's not a cash generative business, and it is extremely difficult to get through the first 5 or 10 years. But we've got a wonderful record in Britain, people coming through, and in bookselling too. I mean, one talks about the fact that one's getting so huge, and they are, but where was James Hennage? You know, James Hennage came through with nothing much, but a very good idea. He fought his way through, and Ottica's now is part of the establishment, but he fought his way through with very little backing, through sheer courage and drive and stamina. He got his way through. Small people always will, but you must always realise you have not a cat's chance in hell of getting through unless you do understand the significance of running commercially viable businesses as well. You've got to understand the numbers. Pure culture, whether it's bookselling or whether it's publishing or anything else, is doomed to failure. You do have to understand the balance.
You quite understand me, Tim, wouldn't comment on your own position about W.A. Smith's. But it does look from the reports you get as though W.H. Smith has got its formula wrong yet again, so to speak. I mean, one's watched W.H. Smith do different things to try and win back market share and so on in bookselling, newspapers, magazines and other commodities and so on. And yet again, they appear to be under considerable pressure. And it's ironical in a way that one of the companies that was behind the collapse of the Net Book Agreement in about 1995 was WH Smith, which had previously been a great supporter of the network agreement, and you yourself have said that the network agreement was very important for getting Worcester going, giving you the umbrella under which you needed to go. And it struck me that perhaps WH Smith had been squeezed between two forces, unexpectedly. One, the new chains coming along, Worcester, Dotticker's, Borders and the like, and the other, the supermarkets, coming in and taking away a lot of the basic business that W.H. Smith did. Is that a fair description?
Well, I mean, the joke is, if it is a joke, you know, would you invent W.H. Smith now? And I guess the answer probably is no. But I'm not in the camp which says that W.H. Smith need necessarily fail. I think the problem is that they have allowed both their book offer and, I mean, disastrously, their music offer, to become much less good, and especially stationery too, which is unforgivable. I mean, Smith completely dominated the stationery market. Why let somebody else come in and pinch bits off you? I think it's really a simple story of allowing each of their product groups to become second rate and not realizing quick enough that the people out there may be very weak balance sheets, whatever, but have an idea, have a genius for selling books or stationery oils and take market share away. I actually do hope the Smiths falls into the hands of somebody who's not simply going to strip it up and break it up and dump it and turn the stores all into Sainsbury's locals, you know, which is a threat, I think, actually, because there's a very big portfolio, 2.5 million square feet out there and more. I actually hope somebody does take W. Smith and actually does try and reinvent it as a very good middle market stationer, as a very good middle market bookseller, and as a very good middle market newsagent. It is possible, it's a struggle, but they have excellent sites. And there is still in this country, and I'm very glad there is, a real residual affection for W. Smith. For people of my sort of age, it really was part of our lives for so long. Easy to score points against them. They are in a terrible state at the moment. They've made mistake after mistake after mistake, but I believe it is rescuable. I think they could do good middle market bookselling. They could do very good middle market stationery. They're not doing those things at the moment. It's possible for them to do.
Talking about range of product, Tim, I mean, Borders set themselves out, to some extent at least, to be what you might call a multimedia shop, maybe a concentration on books, but go upstairs, you've got marvelous videos and compact discs and the like, so to speak. In Worcester's, you always set yourself against that concept of being a leisure, an entertainment, a cultural outlet. Would you still hold that view, or would you?
I would, definitely. I mean, we experimented, as Tim Coates remember, we experimented with selling classical music in the stores, and we took it out again within 5 minutes. We knew we didn't know enough about it. The space we were giving across to classical music was taking away from the books. I think there's every argument that somewhere like Waterstones should be books, 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 and books, from the point of view of staff expertise, from the point of view of corporate expertise, from the point of view of the corporate dynamism and ambition. And I absolutely think that, I think it's very easy to slip into sort of marketing speak about, you know, places of entertainment and leisure. And it's rather like retail is detail. Everyone thinks it's true because it rhymes, you know, meaning anything, you know. I think it's quite simple. I think literary bookshops should simply be extremely good literary bookshops. And what that means is having a fantastic range of stock, expertly chosen, expertly balanced, with wonderful staff and very long opening hours. And that's what it is. Not discounting, incidentally. That's something else.
Dare we tackle the great dumbing down issue, so to speak? And poor television always gets accused of dumbing down. Undoubtedly, there is more concentration on bestsellers in many bookselling outlets these days than there was. Are we losing out on cultural values, or are we serving our markets better by reaching out to more readers? Carol, do you have a view on that?
I have a view on it. I don't think that it's proven that the market is being dumbed down. I mean, I've had a book in the bestseller list all this year so far, and it's still there, called Star of the Sea by Joseph O'Connor. Yes, it appeared on the Richard and Judy show. We were amazed that it started to sell as it did. It didn't only sell because it was on Richard and Judy, but that book is not an easy read. It's a wonderful piece of literature, and there are now 500,000 copies in print of that third format that's been published since January. I've also got a bestseller called Sheila O'Flanagan, who writes wonderful women's novels, which are much easier to read. I don't accept that just because they are good entertainment, they are dumbing down to an audience. I mean, I think that the reading public here know what they want, and I think if you can give them good writing in a wide range of areas, and I do not at all disparage bestsellers, then I think there's room for everything. But I honestly don't think the market in general is going down.
And we rather enjoy bestsellers by definition.
We
don't
do we? Rather,
yes,
yes,
we rather
yes.
enjoy
them. Especially
yes,
when they're on
what's
our
What's your partners. View on that? What's happening? Just like a quick view on are we dumbing down or aren't we dumbing down?
I would agree with Carol. I don't think we are on the whole. But I think the dumbing down issue does create some quite important issues for publishers. For example, if we accept that television is not quite so Reithian in its mission of trying to educate us rather than just entertain us, I think that in turn opens up a lot of opportunities for publishers. And one of the most interesting examples, I think, recently has been in the type of history books itself. Now that history is not really very good on documentaries and TV anymore, and it's not really taught that seriously in school, you know, you have a terrific upsurge of interest in history books. But if you write them saying this is very scholarly and it's a revisionist blah blah, that's not so good as producing it as a story, presupposing no previous knowledge. And when you get those right, then I think you can sell enormously gratifying numbers of copies.
Yes. Peter, you want that?
Well, I think I'm somewhere midway between the two views that you've just heard. No, I don't think there is an inevitable dumbing down pattern developing. But I think it is what is true in books is true as well in films and television and even newspapers, that there's a relentless pressure to try to create product and sell product, whether that is a book or whether it's a film or a television show, to the largest number of people, because that is what the requirements are on the producers, given much larger ownerships which are publicly owned. So I think this tendency to try to make everything more successful, larger, have books sell faster, velocity and novelty become a large part of the retailing scene, so that it is more difficult to introduce books of minority appeal. I think it's probably more difficult to introduce films of minority appeal, to get whether documentaries or television shows that have minority appeal. Everybody's after ratings, but I don't believe the public is dumbed down. I don't think they want dumbed down things. I think the public is there. The access is more difficult, but I think as Stephen was saying earlier, if you work very, very hard at it, and I think he means that also for larger companies, you can get the attention of retailers, and you must, but you really need a lot of passion for it today. It is harder. And the numbers are also sometimes smaller to start than they were some years ago. Having said that, the technology also favors smaller size printings, provided the advances are in a right relationship and all the rest of it. So I think all the opportunities are there. I don't think there is any inevitable dumbing down, but it is just harder to get things started.
Stephen, you could actually welcome dumbing down as giving you greater access to the market.
Distinct mission.
A distinct mission, yes.
Yes, well, I think was one of the... I'm struck by the raising of Harville, actually, where obviously an incredibly fine list, but a refusal to present that list in a manner which would have gathered a wider readership. I think that's at the heart of what might appear to be dumbing down. We in the sort of, you know, on the cultural end of publishing have to be immensely energetic about the way that we present and publish the books. And have to be unashamed about having ambition for things. There's not the idea of a sort of canon that is handed down to readers does not exist anymore. We have to go out energetically and find that readership. And so we have to use some skills that are more regularly employed for more mainstream product or books. And one of the things about that, I think, is that, I mean, when I came to Faber, we stopped packaging Faber in a, you know, the black with the box and the FF. And I got quite a lot of the sort of central TLS world saying, awful shame that you've ditched the black, you know. And, well, we doubled the readership of at least three or four writers that we did that to immediately. So it tells you that you just cannot restrain culturally important work. You have to be ambitious and go after it and be of your time, and the time is very much a marketing culture.
It's interesting, the whole parallel debate, isn't there, to be had in television as to whether the increased number of digital television channels and the new way in which the industry is becoming structured is going to have the same effect on what's put out on television, whether we are going to get a range of companies which have the same effect as broadsheet newspapers and tabloid newspapers, which we call tabloid the popular newspapers these days, which I don't suppose you can, but still, or in publishing, where you get people who concentrate on the more literary end of the business and people who concentrate on the more best-selling end, or like Orion, where you have two companies, one of which concentrates on quality and one of which concentrates on popular, it's fair to say, Anthony, is it? I mean, that's how I saw your structure.
Well, devotees of the crime list.
Yes.
Not like to see that put in the non-cultural pot.
No, I suppose they wouldn't, but you could argue that point, couldn't you? Tim, I've asked you that question already about dumbing down the way. Anything to add to that debate?
I think it's right. I think anybody who tries to dumb down whatever it is, a publishing house, a bookseller, it's going in the wrong direction. I mean, speaking as a lifelong member of the Labour Party, the single horror of the first term was the Cool Britannia campaign, which made me sort of still make sweat drip off my back when I remembered it. I mean, I think actually Britain is fine. I think we're going in the right direction. There are hundreds of thousands of people who go through our great exhibitions and our great galleries here. Concert halls are full in London every night. We're doing great. And I think, if anything, where the market is going, in anything, is up rather than down. And the truly skilled marketing is to follow the people up.
It's terribly patronising to make an assumption about the general audience, the larger consumer audience, and say that because something is popular, it has to be bad. It absolutely, categorically, does not have to be bad.
No, I think we'd all agree with that, actually, but I know that's how the debate does get polarised, doesn't it? One interesting aspect of all of that, though, of the difficulty of keeping a range of titles in print, diversity and so on, is the impact that the digital world is going to have on us in the future. There's an interesting story in the newspapers this morning that I think it's the British Film Institute is now setting up more of an archive of films in digital form, which can then be made available either on demand or via digital television channels and so on. And they make the point in that many films which won't get a showing in cinemas, and of course many don't already, but many which are foreign films, for example, which get poor distribution in the United Kingdom, can nevertheless be stored and accessed via the digital medium. I don't think there's much sign yet of that happening in books. If anything, book publishers have not felt the need, the trade book publishers have not felt the need, I guess, to make their books available in digital form, which would be different for reference publishers and to some extent for academic publishers. But is the digital world going to have an impact on book publishing? Is it going to be a way of meeting demand that's relatively small but nevertheless important? Is it going to revolutionise the world? Are we taking adequate steps to deal with the digital world? I mean, the record industry is heavily criticised for not having got its act in order before Napster came along and started to make downloads available for a time at no charge. How are we coping with that opportunity, that threat, that technological change? Peter, do you have a view on that?
Well, from the earliest days, or at least my earliest days in publishing, the role of the publisher in respect of formats was overemphasized. And then after vertical publishing developed, there was a much clearer recognition that copyright is king. So a lot of the fears that you have sort of expressed, or the questions you've asked of whether publishing is going to go the route of industries that have been ravaged, such as the music industry and the efforts of the film industry to sort of get ahead of the wave, and the fact that the audiobook industry is menaced, if you like, as well by not digitalization but file sharing. These issues are all handleable if there is a kind of protection for copyright. Curiously, book publishing is very traditional. Traditional in the way we access the printed page. The printed page is our great bastion in a strange way. People like reading, particularly works of narration. I enlarge that word works of narration to mean not only fiction, but also biography, especially history. People don't want to read on screens at the present time, and I think they're extremely unlikely to. And no higher contrasting colors will probably ever be produced than ink on paper or black on white. So I think a large portion of our industry is going to be resistant for a very long time. But there have been, and you didn't mention them, efforts to digitize publishing. Efforts is the wrong word, successful efforts. The e-book is a rather remarkable format. It's just not become very important. But we haven't talked much about academic publishing and educational publishing. And I think e-book formats and reference book formats and quite a few areas of publishing today will move down that digital highway. But, as an aspect of Newtonian physics, for every action there's a comparable reaction. And we all as publishers have to be creative, not only in publishing in the traditional form that we are very privileged, rather longer than perhaps other industries to publish into, to prepare ourselves for change.
Carol, how important do you as an agent take the electronic rights now?
Electronic rights in the area that I work in, which is general commercial fiction and non-fiction, shading over into very literary, but the general market, is almost insignificant. I'm pleased to say, as Peter's pointed out, people, reading is a very personal and sensuous pleasure. People like reading for themselves. It's wonderful that audiobooks have become as popular as they are, but they still are not as popular as print on paper. And I don't think anybody's going to start selling e-books in large quantities because the audience isn't there. We can't produce a format that buyers don't want. And I think our greatest protection is the fact that people like reading for themselves.
And we better move towards allowing the audience to ask some questions, make some points. But just one final question, perhaps, for you all. This week, I noticed it's a rollover on the National Lottery. And on Sunday morning, you look at your Sunday papers and you find that you're the proud winner of £10 million. But it won't help Tim to buy W.A. Smith's, I have to say. But would you invest that £10 million in book publishing today, Tim?
I'm an absolute sucker for publishing startups. I seem to have got 2% of every publishing startup in the last 10 years, so the answer is yes. I think literature
and your
books are hugely important.
Anyway, yes. Steve, would you? It's your only £10 million.
It would have to be the right kind of business.
Well said. Peter?
I'd probably put in five and invest the other half for children and grandchildren.
Some of them may have £10 million already, I don't know, but Anthony, what about you?
I concur with my colleagues. Yeah.
Right, I see, we're not going to get a great, very cautious attitude about £10 million. And you, Carol?
I've never bought a lottery ticket because I do all my gambling at work. I think I would like to run a bookshop, but I'd only want to sell the books that I like.
Yeah. Okay. That might be difficult.
I know.
That's what it used to be.
That's why I don't buy lottery.
That's what it used
to
be like. No. Right, well, let's turn over to the audience. I should just say that the session is being recorded on behalf of the National Sound Archive. I've told everybody except you as it happened. I saw you weren't in that little group. When you're asking questions, you might like to remember that the National Sound Archive, based at the British Library, is treasuring your every word, and indeed Sue Bradley, who is actually no relation of mine as far as we know, is here in the audience to make sure it all gets down. But let's hand over to the audience. Somebody should have a microphone somewhere, please. Would you just say who you are and what you do, so to speak, and if you want to aim the question at a particular person, say who?
Right, my name is Florence Châtelain, and I work at Orion Publishing as a European sales rep. So hello, Anthony.
Could you speak a little bit
louder?
Could you
put the microphone closer to your mouth?
Right. So I was just wondering if, on the European scene, do you feel as a publisher you have a responsibility? We were talking about quality of books, and on the more literary side, because I do find that, you know, the bestsellers that we are trying to push in England are not necessarily what is selling in Europe, and there is a need for quality. Do you take that market into account, or do you go with the globalization and do not really think about the European market?
Who wants to try that one?
I think we, you know, at Faber, we sort of describe ourselves as a European publisher in many ways. We don't, we have a very, very strong Irish list. We have a good list in translation. I think one of the things about the British market, particularly the English market, however, that if you present something as good for you from a foreign culture, it becomes extremely difficult to make it sell. It's a rather sad realization. And so we do a lot of publishing of translated fiction, particularly, which is energetically geared to make it look as if it's of our market. And we get a great deal of success. You know, we just published Orhan Pamuk, and we published Milan Kundera for many years. So I think, you know, you have to be careful in this market, and you have to publish with great energy. And it's not also necessarily true that what's of interest in those European markets is of interest here. But I don't think it's a mark of a lack of quality here. But there's certainly, I think it is sometimes tough to make translated fiction particularly work here.
There's an interesting reverse problem in a way, isn't there, that one understands these days that the idea of English novels or books being translated into languages like Dutch or Danish or something is now greatly diminished because so many people in these countries can read English.
Don't you
anyway.
Believe it?
Is that true?
Okay. No, I mean, we sell almost everything on our list to Dutch publishers. We have many auctions. I mean, some of our authors are in 30, 40 languages. There's an incredibly vibrant publishing scene around the world if you find the right publishers and make the right match.
Right. I was just getting a complaint only a few days ago from a Danish publisher that they couldn't afford any longer to publish many titles in translation.
Oh, I think it's
difficult to do.
Because
the English version had undermined
their
market.
The Dutch and the Scandinavian markets, of course, always are finding competition, not just each from the other, trying to get their own market share. They're competing with very often deliberately low-priced export copies from the UK and the US publishers. And in Denmark, they're competing against the taxman because they've got a tremendously high VAT rate. I take my hat off with admiration to every single Danish publisher I've ever sold anything to.
Another question. Right. Now the microphone coming to you over there.
Hi, I'm Alice. I'm chair of the LSE Media Group. I just wonder what happened to J.K. Rowling. Why did she have such a difficult time in getting her story published?
Right. Do we want to have a special reply from the audience?
Well, he wouldn't know, would he? Because he took it on.
He's the one who got it. He's the one who got it right.
Right. Well, would you want to comment on that then?
It goes back to
Nigel,
the, you know, six
like
editors, seven
Nigel
opinions.
Newton from Bloomsbury, the publisher of J.K. Rowling.
Thank you, Clive. My attempt to be obscure in the back row has now failed.
Failed totally.
Well, the story goes, and I don't know if it's true, that this book was submitted to 8 publishers who turned it down. And allegedly the reason in some cases was that the book was considered to be too long for 8 to 12-year-olds to read. I find that baffling, and I'm sure anyone who's read the much, much, much longer fifth book, which is actually 255,000 words long, that many 8-year-olds skimmed through in about 7 hours, one can see that was an erroneous piece of received wisdom. But we are all the victims of received wisdom in whatever industries we're in, and that may have been a particularly fatal piece of it in those 8 cases. When the book arrived at Bloomsbury, it was read by our children's editorial director, Barry Cunningham. He was immediately taken by the first page and passed it on to his editor, Eleanor Bagnall, sitting next to him, and she passed it to Roz, the marketing manager, sitting next to her, and the three of them read this book in serial form. One of the joys of how we read books, which is on sheets of A4 instead of in books, you can share them. And this was not a difficult decision for them. It was an obvious decision, as it has been for 250 million other readers since.
I should say that in my company, at least, there was a strong view that you couldn't actually publish a children's novel with witches in it at all.
Yeah.
Because the school librarians considered this to be very unpolitically correct.
We had great battles with them about such things that had happened. I must say, my nephews, when they finished Harry Potter, and they get set to page 750, they turn straight back to page 1 and start again, you know. So it's a totally continuous process of reading.
But
another question.
Can I just say there's an important point about in this, which is about taste and passion, and both of which are at the heart of every successful publishing business, be they big, small, be it an agency. You things are not inevitable. You know, you find things that you love, and then you put a whole host of effort behind them. And if you don't do that, then great things can get missed. You know, Bloomsbury's great success with Harry Potter was not just publishing book one successfully, but by always remaining increasingly ambitious with every book that was published, including the last. And I think that's incredibly important when it comes to making books successful.
One of the wonderful things about dealing with smaller publishers, if they can then sell the books they take on, is that the chain of communication is shorter, and so that passion doesn't become as diminished as it sometimes can when in larger companies it has to go through one meeting after another.
Yeah, right. Now, somebody, yes, over there, please.
Yes, thank you. Marie-Pierre Pouli, I'm a PhD student in the sociology of literature. And I wanted to come back on a sentence that Matt Crumb wrote in The Guardian, saying that arguing that Zadie Smith, to some extent, is quite emblematic of the developments in the literary field and publication field of the late 90s, beginning of the 21st century. I wanted to know if you thought it was a fair comment on his part. His point, to some extent, was to say that she has been a literary celebrity before her literary quality was really established. The process is inverted, and that might be a threat to the literary quality of bestseller novels.
Yeah. Anyone want to... Have you got that question?
Yeah. I would say it was a rather unfair point, actually.
Yeah.
I remember reading the first few pages of that book and thinking this is an absolutely outstanding piece of writing. Completely uninfluenced by any media hype that came before it. And that, I think, was certainly also the view taken by her publisher, Richard Penguin, who immediately slapped down a very large money as a floor bill, which took the book. So I would not say that point was correct. I would say that she established her reputation on her quality. If some people were a little disappointed in the second book, that often happens.
I mean, maybe the broader issue is that these days authors almost have to become celebrities to find the market share that publishers want them to have for what they've paid for them. But that's a slightly different issue. And these days we do say to our writers, we do have to sell you as part of the package with the book.
Down here. But the
I'm Sue Pandit from Oxford Brookes University, where we teach publishing. There was an article a couple of months ago in The Bookseller about innovation in publishing. In fact, about how there's not very much lack of innovation in publishing. The author struggled to find examples of innovation across publishing companies, and I think one of the examples was Peter Mayer's The Penguin 60s range was identified. And I'd like to know from the panel whether they agree with this, that trade publishing is poor at innovating, and maybe independent publishers have more scope for innovating than large publishers.
Right. Peter, do you want to have a go at that?
Well, it's nice to have someone like what we did. To think back on that for a moment, it was a rather extraordinary editorial cum production cum marketing enterprise, which represented, I think, what was the best of being a large publisher. As we've spent a lot of time here praising small publishing, which I certainly am today, and independent publishing, what we pulled off there was entrepreneurial in the sense of a large company producing something that we actually thought was a promotion for our 60th anniversary, that it turned into a venture that in 9 months had 29 million copies in print, was well beyond anything I ever imagined. I think the question about originality and initiative and entrepreneurship is actually the key question in all industries, and perhaps even more so in companies or industries that call themselves creative. And I think what's happened, and I think Anthony talked about earlier, about the devaluation of the editor. I think he's right about that. He has less and less to say about what happens to his or her book. I think is part of not looking at what the market wants, needs, is interested in, and creating it for that market. Often going to the agent, as opposed to having the agent always come to the editor. A lot of editors have become shoppers, and they spend all their time processing what agents send them. Well, they should also go to agents, or directly to authors in cases of authors who don't have agents, and say, there ought to be a book on this or that, and I think you're the right person to write it. So I think this creative thing cannot be done by a passive view of yourself as whether you are an editor or whatever your role in a publishing company is. It's actually to think anew. In that particular case of the Penguin 60s, we didn't think this would make an enormous difference to our exchequer. We thought it was a very interesting idea to promote our company, our backlist, and all of that. And it turned out to be something that people wanted. But I think much more creativity belongs in publishing companies than there is. I think, would redress many imbalances if there was more of that. I know the people in publishing at every level think of themselves as creative, but I don't think they are as much as they could be.
Gordon, down here. Come to the next. Trying to bring a bloke in. It was all getting a bit woman-dominated so far. So
you see a problem with that?
No problem at all. No, good question.
Speaking on behalf of the dwindling number of us who have survived unexpectedly into the 21st century, I would like to say how wonderful it is to see how carefully all you young people are handling the legacy that we left to you. I detect a faint air of surprise, Clive, in everything that's been said this evening, that the book is prospering, sort of in spite of everything. And I want to put it to the panel that the book actually has a life of its own. No matter what happens, it can stand up, you see, to all the things that are wrong. The principal criticisms are directed against what we wrongly call conglomerates. I think semantically we have to correct ourselves. A conglomerate is like Vivendi, you know, which was a disaster from the beginning. What we are talking about is large multinational, multimedia corporations. And the basic question is whether they are a good thing. And I'd like to put it to the panel, on balance, and I mean what is generically called balance between commerce and culture, but more exactly between the interests of the author and the reader on one hand and the shareholder on another, whether on balance these corporations are a good thing.
I'm glad you mentioned shareholders, because I think there has been a problem in the way that shareholders have so much power in the larger publishing companies. I think there are very few similar interests between a shareholder who wants to see profit sooner rather than later and an author and maybe a publisher who wants to build up an author's career. That takes longer. I think some of the pushes and pulls we've seen have come because of those two areas colliding. Although I don't hate large companies on the whole, because they have large checkbooks too.
It is interesting, the investor pressure, though, isn't it? That once upon a time we used to talk about a 10% return as being a good return from publishing. Now you have to talk 25, 30, even 40%, so to speak, which is pressure coming from the market.
It's unrealistic.
I don't think that size is necessarily bad, and I think some big publishers are extremely fine publishers and take brave positions on books which might well fail and get behind things. I don't think it's that. I just think that good companies are good companies and bad companies are bad companies. And there's plenty, just like there's some really very, very poor independent booksellers that we all have to be very pious about, but in fact are rotten booksellers. So there are also some very poor small publishers and some very good small publishers. I think quality will always out. What really outs in publishing, because the finances of it are so difficult, the lack of cash flow, the lack of cash generation, is the people with imagination and with drive and with real, real drive, Nigel Newton, get through. And it's not bad as, big is bad, and it isn't like that. There's some very fine publishing going on in the big houses and some very bad publishing going on in the small houses and vice versa.
Okay. I think a lady over there wanted to ask a question. Who was it? No? Gone? If not, David Kingsley.
David Kingsley. We've all been using the marketing word, and to my surprise, nobody yet has referred to what has been the biggest marketing effort that we've seen for many years, the television programs, which were the series that was put out. And I'd be very interested to know whether you think there are pluses and minuses and what you feel about that particular kind of marketing. We all know that it had a tremendous impact, but what about, as it were, the rest of the business?
You're talking about the big read in that case, I think, David. Yes, that's right, yeah. Right. Who's been affected by that? Stephen, any thought on?
Yes, I mean, I think what you want is a very healthy book trade, selling a lot of books to a lot of readers, and while everybody will have a view of the 100 books that were part of the original Big Read selection, I can't see it as anything but a force for good. We sold an extra 100,000 Lord of the Flies as a result of that television. And we will relaunch William Golding's backlist, which was struggling as a result. And it's a huge opportunity for us to bring a very fine writer a new audience. So I can't think that we can be anything other than joyous, because it is one of the factors, along with Richard, Judy and others, that has created growth, excitement, glamour around books. I mean, in fact, some of the things I think we should not stop our ambition there and rather wonder, gosh, was this good for us? And I think actually we should be much bolder than that and be saying, well, look, books are good for television. We need to find a way. We've never cracked as an industry television as a way of promoting books properly. And this is a big opportunity, a moment when we've really met, a part of television that will promote.
It really is a great development, actually. I used to go and see the heads of arts in Radio 4 and BBC 2 and so on, and they always said they didn't want to do programmes about books because they knew that publishers wanted them because it promoted their books. To which one said, exactly. But why not?
The head of arts at BBC was at the BA conference last month, and he was waxing lyrical about the Big Read. He was even complimentary about Richard and Judy, which is not on his show, and saying, books are sexy now. They're making more programmes. Yeah. And it's true.
I just want to bring in one more questioner, so to speak. We've got in the audience Tim Coates, who has been managing director of Waterstones in his time, I think I'm right in saying, Tim, and has recently written the report for Libri on the public library service. Do you just want to take this chance, Tim, to say something?
Thank you very much, Clive. I'll ask your colleagues on the panel if they might find a way to enthuse about the values of the public library service, because in the report, which you've said had fantastic publicity, unfortunately the findings are that the public library service in the UK is virtually in collapse and needs a tremendous amount of support and needs a tremendous amount of improved management. If your colleagues could endorse that, I'd be very grateful.
Do we regard the public library network as being an important means of for readers to access literature, education, knowledge, ideas, and so on?
I think it's absolutely vital. I think the sad thing about the public library movement is it allowed itself to get totally on the back foot in the 1980s, and very defensive and very complaining about the growth of literary bookshops, about Mrs. Thatcher's lack of funding, and they allowed themselves to become martyrs in their own eyes, and nobody grabbed it. Well, some librarians did. There's some good examples around the country of individual librarians that ignored their colleagues and went ahead and but as a whole the movement lost all its drive, and I think it's a very sad thing, and I'm totally who could not be in favour of the most magnificent public library service, and should be challenging bookshops, and it is true, and Tim's report I thought was absolutely dead on. It is so that the industry has lost its drive, lost its self-confidence, and it's got a long way to come back in order to compete with the great literary booksellers.
But haven't we got
I pray they do.
A special problem here, which is that people have forgotten what libraries are actually for. Are they for access to knowledge, i.e. should you get access to computer terminals and so on through libraries, or are they for books? If we decide they're for books, which happens to be my belief, then you know, one has to regret that the funding has gone so far in other directions, as well as going down, so that for a general publisher today, the library market is no longer even looked at as a separate item where you might say that'll be 20% of the print run or something. Whereas 15 years ago, it was invariably reckoned as a really important account. Yeah, I think that's a great pity.
They need a champion, actually, and the library movement does not have a champion of government, hasn't had for years.
That's correct, and yes. And certainly I agree with Anthony that when I go to my public library, the space taken over by computers, by what is now, I think, called the People's Network, isn't it, Tim? As a great government, a great new Labour way of making libraries more vibrant by using IT as the way of doing things rather than improving the book stock and improving the opening hours and so on. So I agree, I think the idea of a champion of a library is a very important one, one that the library world needs to take on board.
If I can just say so, don't forget the initiative that Amanda Ridout at HarperCollins was partly responsible for bringing together to actually bring the library network into reading groups and things like that. And we've got experience of authors giving talks in libraries. I mean, as an agent, I prefer people to buy books than borrow them. But I want books to be in libraries so that my authors can go and give talks there. And then, you know, people will buy books in libraries and will go out and buy books from bookshops. And we have very direct evidence of that.
That might happen. One more question. I think we probably do mind.
I just wanted to make a statement, actually. You just worried me quite a lot in what you just said. I'm, amongst other things, I'm an author. I also run a website. And this idea of the People's Network being in libraries, we have a massive problem in this country from people being disenfranchised to information, access to financial services, access to good information, which the library system is finally, thankfully, addressing. And whilst I agree, let's put books back in there, let's have the Big Read books in there, let's have the Rich and Judy books in there, like they do in bookshops, sell it the same way. But don't get rid of the computers. I live in Shepherd's Bush, let me tell you. There are people there who would be absolutely screwed to high heaven if they couldn't have the computer access in the library. And I'm sure that wasn't what you meant, but this is being recorded for the sound archive, and let's get it right. Yeah. Computers in libraries are fantastically valuable.
I think the point we were making
important.
Was that computers have been squeezed into existing library buildings. And you're trying to get a quart into a pint pot, in fact. That's the great problem. And books... Well, I'm not saying anything against the idea of the People's Network as a means of giving people access to computers and all that lies behind the web and so on. But it is the great problem that, if you take my local library, for example, about half the space is now occupied by computers, definitely at the expense of book stock and readability within the particular library. What you actually need, and I think Tim's report would support this, is an improvement of the premises. And I think libraries as information centres is quite an important concept as well. But I think you need an improvement of the premises, not saying we've got the existing building stock. We have very few new public libraries. We do have them in Croydon and Peckham and places like that, which are quite successful in that way. But a place like the one which Tim and I have actually looked at, there's been very little expansion of the building space, the space you need to cope with modern information services. And I'm a great supporter of information services. Indeed, I sat on the government's Information Age Partnership to expand access to the digital world. And I think it's very important. I think it's important for publishing as well. Now, I think actually we've just one more question there. Can we just...
My name's Corinne Sweet. I'm actually a writer and a broadcaster, and I have the great honour of having Carol Blake as my agent. One of the few, I think, have managed to crawl in under the door at some point. I write self-help books and non-fiction as well as fiction, and I'm part of a group of women. We did call ourselves the SHAG group originally, which was Self-Help Authors Group, and then we decided to change it for reasons of bad taste. And we've also, most of us have been on Rich and Judy waving our books and hopefully have sold books. But one thing that the ex-SHAG group, now called BARB, which is British Authors of Relationship Books, one thing that we discuss avidly is the fact that our books don't travel over the Atlantic. but the Atlantic books seem to swamp our books in Britain. And a lot of us write our books very much for the British audience, knowing the British reserve has got to be chiselled away with the odd JCB, and that the American language yet still seems to take over, you know, what we seem to be doing for the British market. So what we're saying is, why do people buy the Mars and Venus books but don't buy our books? Or why do, say, booksellers or Smiths or other big companies, they seem to push the American books rather than the British books, and we'd like to see that change.
Well, Peter, any comments straddling the Atlantic?
Well, I think the question is addressed to British publishers who publish ostensibly those books that they admire and those books that they can sell. I think these are individual decisions made in every British publishing company. There are American publishing companies that publish a great many British books. I do. I publish at Overlook. Perhaps a third of the list is British. I don't know the answer. It may be that there are some media, like film, which are very dominated by American films. I don't know to what extent British television is. I rather think it isn't. There is a lot of American stuff on British television, but there's quite a bit of British stuff on American television in reverse. There are some news magazines like Time and Newsweek which don't have an exact parallel in Britain, and so they're to some extent marketing is part of the game. But I think it's something that is addressed every day in a way that is not satisfactory to you by British publishers and editors, and I don't think I can answer it.
It might be something also to do with, again, the selling and marketing process, where often American books in this market come with a track record. They come with a certain... If you look at the American bestseller list, there are many more Mind, Body and Spirit success, you know, top 20 hits in that, and they stick and they stay. And I think maybe that just helped. It's easier. It's easier to say it worked there, maybe it'll work here. Maybe. That's one thing.
I don't want to open up a whole new subject at this stage of the evening, but I was rather surprised and actually slightly shocked when there was some discussion about opening up the Booker Prize, which is sponsored by our sponsors of the evening, says he, giving his message, that if it became a complete English language prize as opposed to a Commonwealth prize, then American authors would always win, which seemed to me to be a highly contestable thought, quite frankly. I don't know. But I don't want to open up another topic, because I think I know when a reception beckons, so to speak, and a glass of something and a canapé looms, and there is going to be a reception now, which you're all very welcome to come to, which will be on the fifth floor in the senior dining room, I think it's called, and people will show you where to get to, how to get there, and gives a further chance for conversation. But I hope, I'm not going to try to sum up, because that's quite hopeless on this sort of discussion, but I hope that one has got across the extraordinary vibrancy of the industry we're talking about, the people who are there. My experience is over 20, 25 years in book publishing, as opposed to other parts of the industry, are you're always coming across people, authors, publishers, booksellers of incredible brilliance, of incredible enterprise, offering an incredible range of product to the British market and indeed to world markets. And it is really one of the most enjoyable, if difficult, industries to work in, because you are constantly coming across these people of enormous talent. And I think we've had some of them here this evening, and it's been marvellous to hear the views of you all. Thank you all very much for participating this evening. I hope you'll now join us in the reception, and we'll meet more people in the audience and continue the conversation. And thank you to the LSE Media Group for organising it this evening. And thank you all for coming.
Hello, I'm Alice. I'm the chairman of the LSE Media Group. I'd like to thank the panel and, of course, our sponsor for tonight. In particular, I'd like to thank the producer, Tesh, who's on our committee for producing such a wonderful event tonight. So the Media Group It's targeted at everybody who has an interest in the media or who works in the media. It doesn't matter whether you're an alumni or not. So if you're interested in joining, you can approach me later on, or Nat, who is in lilac shirt, and you can talk to him. In a year, we organize about 5 debates, and it's on current media issues. And the definition for media, for the media group, is very wide. So it ranges from books to films to TV to broadcast to journalism to advertising and PR. So if you have interest or you work in those areas and you would like to know about the latest topics, please join us. And thank you very much for coming. And please come to the fifth floor and have a drink with us. Thank you very much.